Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 60, Healing the Addictive Personality, November 15, 2006. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Recovery from an addiction is really a deeply spiritual journey. Because any time that we come to a place of pausing and saying, wait a minute, my happiness is not out there. It must be in my relationship with myself and my relationship with my higher power. And that looking outside of myself has caused me tremendous pain.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Lee Jampolsky, who's both a friend and one of my former students. Having confronted and conquered his own addictions, he's the author of the book Healing the Addictive Mind, which came out 14 years ago, and now he's currently at work on a follow-up book on that same topic, which will be titled Healing the Addictive Personality. Meanwhile, he also has four other books in print and four that he's working on. He's not had what would be described as an easy life. From the turmoil of addiction and loss to living through and beyond disabilities and chronic health problems, he's grown and found purpose by using what he teaches in his own life. With humor and from the heart, Lee has a unique ability to help people discover and realize their dreams and full potential. He's become a renowned psychologist and a widely published author and a highly effective and entertaining presenter. His books are in 14 languages, and combined with his international lecturing, Lee continues to touch and motivate people around the globe. His inspirational presentations span the fields of health, business, education, spirituality, and psychology. He's a recognized leader in psychology and human potential, and he served on the medical staff and faculty of respected hospitals and graduate schools, consulted management and CEOs of businesses of all sizes, and has contributed to the spiritual growth of numerous groups and organizations. His writings and teachings contain a deep understanding, yet have direct practicality. Simply put, Lee believes in a successful and balanced life. Thus, you can find him enjoying his kids, friends, and many animals while playing and laughing as much as possible. Most importantly, Lee strives to come from compassion in all he does. And I think that will come through in the interview right now. Dr. Lee Jampolsky, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dave.
And I wish that my listeners could see, I wish we were on video, because I'm here in Dr. Lee Jampolsky, my former student, so you're Lee to me.
Yeah, well, I'm Lee to most people.
Okay, I'm not going to doctor you a whole bunch in this conversation, but we're sitting at the dining room table in your lovely home in Carmel Valley, and for people who don't know California or don't know Carmel, this is certainly one of the more beautiful areas in the United States. And there's so many different things that we could talk about because you've been writing lots of books and exploring lots of different areas over the years. But I know one of your areas of expertise is the area of addictions. And I've heard from several listeners that they would like to have me interview somebody who had some expertise in the area of addictions. And in fact, let's talk about addictions. I think maybe you even had some personal experience. Maybe that's how you first got into this. Let's get up close and personal here.
Words out.
Yeah, let's start there.
I think it's important to note that regardless if it's books on addiction or other aspects of my work, that how I come to write about something is not really by being an expert on it. I tend to write about what I most want to learn about.
Okay.
And when I wrote the book Healing the Addictive Mind, it's been 15, 16 years ago now. That book's now in 14 languages around the world. And
wow, congratulations.
Thank you. You know, yeah. It feels great. And I'm now working on a book that'll be out in October of 07 called Healing the Addictive Personality. And as you said, I came to the field of addiction and treatment from my own struggles.
Mm-hmm.
And I really began to look at, after many, many, many years of all types of addiction, ranging from drugs and alcohol to relationship stuff to work, I really came to begin to ask myself some deeper questions about what the nature of addiction is. And I come at it slightly differently than what many people think about addiction as. There's few people out there who really want to or would like to consider themselves an addict.
Right.
But if we really think about what addiction is, I come to the conclusion that any time that we're looking outside of ourselves for happiness, we're setting ourselves up for a road of addiction. And that broadens the definition up tremendously.
Yeah, that seems very, very broad.
Very broad. So what that means is that when we're, that the origins of addiction are not in some chemical or in some relationship or in some thing out there that we ingest in our body somehow, but the origins of addiction really come from our own thinking. And that when we are in a belief system that says, my happiness is somewhere out there, and a substance and a relationship and an amount of money in my bank account, that what I see is my happiness is out there, I'm going to be heading down the road of addiction.
Hmm. Okay. Now, do I recall correctly, and this is backing off just a little bit from the theory for a moment, weren't you heading up an alcohol program for a while through a hospital? What was that job that you had some years ago?
For a lot of years, I was very interested in really looking at how we could bring treatment to the broadest number of people. So I was very interested in looking at outpatient treatment and bringing it both to adolescents and adults. So I don't know how, I'm not too good at time frames. Back in the 80s and 90s, I guess, I started few programs that are still in existence today. But really, again, those programs came and still are coming from the place of seeing that recovery from an addiction is really a deeply spiritual journey. Because any time that we come to a place of pausing and saying, wait a minute, my happiness is not out there. It must be in my relationship with myself and my relationship with my higher power, and that looking outside of myself has caused me tremendous pain. Some of what I believe was talked about many years before I came and put... One of the things that I do, I think, well, is taking a broad amount of information from a number of different traditions and incorporating them into a program that works and is relatively simple. I don't necessarily think of myself as an original thinker or somebody who has more smarts than the next guy. What I try and do is use myself kind of as a guinea pig.
Okay, and then synthesize.
And if it works for me, then I begin to look at how it might help other people and then document it through that way.
Yeah. So what has worked for you?
I think, you know, in the book Healing the Addictive Mind, what I talk about a lot is when we see the patterns that we do repeatedly and we begin to look at, the origins of those and stop them, we get a lot of self-insight. For example, I was very much involved in playing a number of games in my head that caused me a tremendous amount of pain for most of my life.
For example,
the when-then game. Always believing that when X, Y, or Z happened, then I would feel complete, whole, and happy. when I had enough money, when I had the right spouse, when I had the right letters after my name, when I had the right home, when I lived in the right place, whatever it might be. I oftentimes think of myself as somebody who for several decades had what I call a rotating carrot machine affixed to the top of my head. And it dangled a nice, juicy carrot out in front of me.
Yeah.
And I would work very hard to get that, very diligently, very hard worker. And when I would finally arrive at that carrot, it was a relatively ruthless machine because that carrot would drop by the wayside and I would be off to the next one.
A new carrot would rotate into place.
A new carrot would rotate back up. And so I was constantly in this when-then mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to that game is oftentimes the if-then.
Mm-hmm. You know?
If I had had a different family, if X, Y, or Z hadn't happened to me, if I had had more opportunity in my life, then I would be able to be achieving the level of happinesses that I would like to have.
Yeah.
And it simply doesn't work that way. And really part of recovery and in my spiritual path is really taking that and owning it.
So you examined yourself, you saw that you were in these patterns.
Correct.
And so what was the next step?
Well, one of the integral parts of the steps, if you will, is looking at what drives us to look outside of ourselves for happiness. Why do we do that? Why don't we just claim our own peace, our own joy, our own happiness that's in the present moment? What drives us to look outside all the time to begin with? And what I really discovered the more I looked at it was guilt and shame. That we don't want to look at our own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much easier to shove it under the carpet, shove it down, or blame other people for it,
right,
than it is to look at it, mm-hmm. examine it, forgive. And it's remarkable to me that when we actually begin that process, and to me oftentimes it's a lifelong process, that that's where our peace comes from. And I was talking to somebody recently, a couple of days ago, and I realized that, and I don't mean to make myself sound like I'm there or have arrived, but there's certain things on my spiritual path that I go, wow, that is so different than it used to be for
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to be terrified. I used to be very uncomfortable in my own skin. That's why I used drugs and alcohol to the extent that I did. You know, you mentioned you know, we've known each other over 30 years. You were really integral and responsible for me to begin this journey, which I've had tremendous gratitude through years about. But shortly after I was at Sonoma State, where you were a professor, I went to graduate school. And I remember I had to give a presentation in front of 12 people that lasted about 5 minutes. It was really nothing. To have the spotlight on me for even that small of a period of time was so terrifying that I literally dropped out of graduate school.
Wow.
And I moved to a small town, and I told myself I was going to write. And really what it was an excuse to isolate even more. Mm-hmm. And I escalated my drug use back then. And all because I was so ashamed of who I was. And uncomfortable mm-hmm. with who mm-hmm. I was.
So how did you,
today I make my living by speaking in front of large groups of people.
Yes, you do.
Okay. And how I got there was a journey away from this whole concept of looking outside of myself for happiness. Let me give you an example. Actually, let me give you a humorous example. Let's imagine for a moment that I come here and I have this newfound drug. Great new pill. Don't have to worry about any side effects. It's not going to make any difference at all. You won't even know that you took it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The only thing that this drug will do is that for the next 24 hours, everybody on the planet will be able to see every thought that you have, every nuance, every dream, every unconscious motive. It'll be open public information. Okay? How many of us are going to go, me first? Let me have that pill. Okay. Now, it's slightly humorous to...
Depends upon whether or not you get high.
Yeah.
Does that go along with it?
You know, the interesting thing, and this may sound somewhat cliché-ish, but to me, the greatest high is letting go of shame. The greatest high is forgiving. The greatest high is not having any more secrets. The greatest high is being able to look at somebody else's eyes and feel who they are and not be hiding who I am. Mm-hmm. The greatest high is getting up in the morning and not feeling like I have yet another day where I have to pretend to be somebody else. And how I get there is by forgiveness, being present, letting go of that level of shame that I had for so long. I've started this by saying I recently was talking to somebody, and in that conversation I said, you know, somehow I've come to a place where I really truly don't have any secrets. That doesn't mean that I have to go around telling everybody every little thing about myself.
Right, right.
But for the first time in my life, there's a sense of freedom that comes from I'm not hiding behind anything. Mm-hmm. There's nothing around that if somebody knew that I'm going to think is, oh my God, that person knows that. Mm-hmm. And that to me is a tremendous release. I can't describe the amount of relief, because for probably 40 years, I did the opposite. You know, always feeling I needed to hide.
Yeah. So if you were to develop a program today, and maybe you have, maybe you are, to reach out to people with addictions, what would that program look like? For example, you use the term higher power, which immediately, of course, made me think of the 12-step program. I don't know if that's played a role in your own evolution or not. What would your program look like today?
Part of what I certainly utilize and advocate for people to use the 12-step program if that works for them. That program, obviously, without any dispute, has helped more people in recovering addiction than anything else.
Is that true? It seems like I've heard that. I don't know if that's something that's been substantiated by research or not.
You know, yes and no. Okay. I mean, this is kind of another subject, but I am not very trusting of research done in the field of chemical dependency, because the information that you're getting, people who are answering the questionnaires are usually people who are doing well. The guy who's back and, you know, sucking on a, you know, crack pipe isn't the guy who's answering the questionnaire.
Okay.
So you get, you know, you're not always getting accurate information.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm always a bit suspect of any of the, if a program says, geez, we've got this great success rate, I'm kind of like, well, who are you interviewing? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a side note on that. What I try and look at about programs is the programs that work, what are some of the key ingredients that make that happen? Okay. Now, as I mentioned before, I kind of, for myself and sometimes for other people, like to look at things in the rawest, most simple and basic form. And to me, it's not, let me go into this by describing a questionnaire that I gave once in a recovery center that will answer this question. One of the questions was, which lectures did you find most helpful? And then I'd add a list of them. Mm-hmm. And this was people who had just gone through the program. And when I was scoring it, I realized that there were several lectures that were no longer being given that got the highest ratings. So
that says something about the value of research.
Exactly. So I began to say, well, it's obviously not all the smart stuff that we're saying to people and the content of lectures and the information that we're imparting. People aren't even basically remembering that. And if they do remember it, then chances are 6 months from now, it's going to be even a more vague and distant memory. So I begin to go, you know, well, what is it? What are the ingredients that really, truly help people? One of the elements of humanistic psychology and existential psychology has this in it, I believe. When people experience a sense of true acceptance from another human being, it creates a ground for change to occur. When people, for the first time, are able to breathe into a relationship or a group or sit in front of another person and have the experience that this person knows all the crap that I've done in my life, all the people I burned, all the people I ripped off, and they're looking at me with love. And they're looking at me and they're seeing something of value in me. That creates magic. Mm-hmm. That creates change. Mm-hmm. When you ask me what elements would a program that I would develop today have, that would be the number one element. Because I don't believe for a second that I can tell any addict or any person for that matter some type of information that's going to change their life. I do believe that the way that I see them and the way that I hold them in the moment does have the capacity to change their life. In my experience, far too many treatment centers, psychologists, psychiatrists don't see this and don't realize it. So too much emphasis is based on how is behavior changing.
Let me push you on this a little bit because okay. Years ago I had some involvement with Synanon. And addicts, heroin addicts, crack addicts, and so on, are notorious for being manipulative, for being dishonest, deceitful, conning. So the question arises in my mind, how effective will giving them this unconditional love really be?
Yeah. I don't know who said it. It might have been Marianne Williamson in one of her books. But, you know, it's a... Forgiving somebody, seeing the light in somebody, doesn't mean that you give them the car keys and go out to lunch with them. That you realize, seeing the light in somebody, really seeing who they are, doesn't mean that you don't hold them accountable for their behavior. It doesn't mean that you look at them and say, well, gee, now that I'm seeing love and light in you, you're not going to manipulate, lie, and cheat me. Okay? It means that I see beyond their behavior. But I still hold them accountable for their behavior. I kind of look at it as the difference between the light and the lampshade. That you might walk into somebody's house and there sitting on the table is the most hideous lamp that you've ever seen in your entire life. I mean, the lampshade is paisley, whatever it is. It's just ugly. But if I asked you, well, Dave, how does that light work? What's that lamp? You'd say, well, you know, there's some electrical current that goes through there and it creates a light. And, you know, you'd be identifying with what is in common with all lights, not the lampshade. In the same way, when I sit in front of an addict and who's new in recovery, if you will, and perhaps manipulative and lying and in denial and all of the things that you describe, I try not to identify with the behavior, which is the lampshade, which is a long list of hideous behavior.
Right.
Okay. I try and identify with who they really truly are beyond and beneath that. But that doesn't mean, you know, I think our culture, to some degree, in the medical model, has done a disservice. And I'll be talking some about this in my book, Healing the Addictive Personality. They've done a disservice in some ways that, and I hesitate to say this because some people take offense to it. I do believe that sometimes the disease model and the medical model of alcoholism and chemical dependency certainly has a help, and I do believe there's probably a genetic predisposition, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. However, too many people use that for, I got a disease, I'm off the hook.
Yeah, for an excuse.
And they don't use it as an opportunity to see beyond it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I try and help people with, regardless if it's around chemical dependency or if they're struggling with a physical disease or some other type of personal challenge, is to help them to look at what's the lesson here. What is the lesson here for you to learn? When I woke up some from continuing to use drugs and alcohol. I began to ask myself, and I have been doing so for the last several decades, what's the lesson here for me to learn? Okay? And the lessons always have to do, for me anyway, and I think for most of us who are on a spiritual path, is what? How can I become a more loving and forgiving and kind person through this experience? And if I'm able to embrace and do that, then I stop blaming. I stop having a whole lot of shame. I stop giving a lot of power to all of my guilty thinking. I stop pointing my fingers at governments, people, spouses, kids as being the source of my problem. And I begin to focus on, Lee, what is it you can do this moment, right now, to shift your perception from one of being fear-based and pain to being more focused on love and compassion and kindness?
Some of my listeners might be wondering when they, you've referred a number of times to spirituality and your sense of spirituality, whether or not that's rooted in Buddhism or Christianity or daily meditation or daily prayer or some other practice. Do you care to reveal anything along those lines?
Sure. When I talk about spirituality, it really isn't the same as talking about religion or theology. When I talk about spirituality, I'm really referring to the what I believe to be the need for a universal experience of love, forgiveness, kindness, compassion, that is beyond what some of us tend to think about certain dogma associated with certain religions. And I certainly think that there's many, many paths that one can embark on that are spiritually rich and can be truly life-changing experiences. I try, again, to look not necessarily at one path, but what the world's spiritual traditions have to say that are in unison and common and that are perennial truths. So spirituality to me is both a very personal relationship that I have, but also is a universal relationship when it comes to really tapping into an experience where you're feeling compassion and love beyond what you might think is personally capable of.
Okay. Now, you had your first book that you wrote some time back was called Healing the Addictive Mind, and you're working right now on another book 14 years later about addiction, and the title of that one that's coming up?
Healing the Addictive Personality.
Okay, so what's the difference between those two books? What was the central thesis of the first book, and what's the evolution been now into this later book?
I think some of it is reflective of my own path. And although I still stand by and feel that Healing the Addictive Mind is an important book, the tone of Healing the Addictive Mind is a psychologist writing to whoever may read that book. So although I do share personal stories and my own pain and recovery in Healing the Addictive Mind, I think 15 years ago I still had a fair amount of guardedness up. I was still in my role as psychologist. And much of how my own path has come is that I really do believe that to the level that I affect truly deep change in people is to the degree that I'm willing to be truly vulnerable and open and share my own path. I think Healing the Addictive Personality won't be done until March, so I can't really say how it will all unfold. But my intention is that it will be, you'll feel just much more of my own heartbeat in the book than perhaps you did in Healing the Addictive Mind.
So that's interesting as I hear you say that. It sounds like you don't have that book really mapped out as exactly what you're going to say, but that it's going to kind of emerge out of your inner process. Is that right?
People often ask me how I write. I'm fairly prolific. You know, we were talking earlier, I've got 4 books underway right now, 2 of which have contracts for. So things kind of, I've always written and it comes relatively easy to me. But I kind of laugh at myself sometimes because I always write an outline and I never follow it. So it gives me some sense of an idea for the overall aspect of the book. But most of my writing really does emerge as I'm doing it. And I like what Ernest Hemingway said one time, that a mark of a truly great writer is not how much they write, but how much they're willing to throw away. Mm. So
do you throw away stuff?
I throw away a lot. Oh. And, you know, I try in these days anyway. But actually, I'll tell you kind of how it works for me. I went this last summer to Mexico with my kids. They were in school during the day, and I was going to write a particular book in health psychology. And as I kept writing, I was, for the first time, felt like I was hitting this writer's block, you know, and nothing was coming out, at least nothing that was worthwhile.
Uh-oh.
And so I stopped and I kind of said, well, what's going on here, you know, and really took a more contemplated stance to it. And the message that I got was quite moving to me, especially when I began to listen to it. And it was that, you know, Lee, you've studied a lot of psychology, a lot of spiritual traditions. You're a fairly disciplined guy. You read a lot. You need to stop all of that.
Hmm.
And I was surprised because I've always kind of even prided myself on, I'm very, you know, spend X amount of time every day reading, meditating, praying. And the message was very clear, stop doing all of that. And I kind of hesitated, and as I was more receptive to what that was about, what I began to really get was that you need to find unexpected teachers. And what I began to do was every day to wake up and have the goal to find deep spiritual teachings in everyday people and mm-hmm. everyday circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been very, and then to write some about those. So it's been a very interesting and very different path.
Sounds exciting to do that. Because it sounds like it's a path of unending discovery.
It is. And it's amazing, really. Not always comfortable. Not always comfortable because I come up against my own limitations, some, and my own sort of patterned ways of thinking and disguised judgments and pieces of guilt that I've yet to let go of.
Yeah, yeah. It feels to me like we're probably getting near the end of our conversation here, and I'm wondering if there's anything that you'd like to say that hasn't been evoked yet.
I think, you know, because this is on addiction and because it is such a full subject and because we've devoted 30 minutes and kind of bounced around a little bit, that it might be good to think about what's truly at the heart of the matter.
Okay, let's do that.
And for me, you know, Aldous Huxley, at the end of his life, was asked, this was imparted to me, I never read it, but I believe it probably to be true, that he said, you know, after being a great philosopher of our time, you know, what you're departing this world, what would you leave us with? And I think probably the person who asked was expecting a fairly, probably had tape recorder in hand, you know, ready for a lot. And my understanding is what he said was about the best I could say would be to be a little kinder than you need to be. And if I were to say what gets in the way and what continues people in the path of addiction, it is their own self-judgment, their lack of forgiveness, their own criticism to themselves, their own belief that they've done unforgivable things. their own shame and their own guilt for all of the things that they've done. But they don't want to look at that because they believe that it's real. So they continue in the same patterns because it somehow pushes it away for a moment, a week, or however long it might be. I'd like your listeners to know that I was king of that, and I know it far too well, and that I spent many, many, many years doing just that. And I now can speak from my own personal experience that it is possible, through really committing to being a little kinder than we need to be to ourselves every day, to really believing that it's possible to forget, to believing that there's a power greater than ourselves that looks completely beyond all of that behavior and sees something worthwhile in us. That if we spend a little time each day doing that, that that is recovery. I remember when I was working at the recovery center, it was a hospital-based program, and they were very formal. I had to wear a tie and pastel shirt and all that stuff that goes along with, and a name tag. And the name tag said, I think, Dr. Lee Jampolsky Recovery Center or something like that. And it never quite fit, so I went to the guy who makes the name tags, and I asked him if he'd make me a different one. And my name tag that I wore said Lee, and beneath that it said Remembering Human Being. And to me, being a remembering human being is remembering to be kind. Be kind to myself, be kind to a few people during the day that I might be tempted not to be. That's recovery, and that's how we can move through addictions. The thing that I would leave your listeners with is, you know, if a guy like me could do it and kind of move ahead a little bit time, that it's possible.
Okay, well, Lee, I want to thank you so much. I feel very moved just hearing the words that you've shared with us, and maybe we can talk again sometime and capture it for
get
folks.
Get you down here once every 14 years.
Well, maybe I'll come down a little bit sooner than that. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
I hope you found this interview as inspiring as I did. The occasion for my visit with Lee was a trip down the California coast this past weekend to co-lead a workshop with my friend Dr. Ron Alexander at the famed Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California. Well, it used to be famed. I'm not sure how famous Esalen is today. In the middle 60s and throughout the 70s, it was known around the world as the go-to growth center where an exciting array of personal growth approaches were being pioneered. Fritz Perls, the founder of Gestalt Therapy, was a sort of therapist in residence there for many years. And everyone who was anyone in the human potential movement was offering workshops there. In fact, even yours truly co-led five-day raft trips down the Rogue River in Oregon and also co-led psychodrama workshops in the High Sierras, both sponsored by Esalen, though not held on the Esalen grounds. Esalen was the brainchild of two Stanford University philosophy grad students, Dick Price and Michael Murphy. They had a vision of creating a center where the greatest minds of the time could come together to exchange ideas. Michael had inherited an incredibly magical piece of property on one of the most spectacularly beautiful sections of the California coast, an area that had once been inhabited by an extremely peaceful Indian tribe known as the Esalen. Many artifacts of this tribe have been found over the years, but never any weapons of war. I'm not given to superstition, but there's a palpable feeling of magic and healing about the place. This feeling is further augmented by hot baths, which are fed by natural sulfur hot springs. Nude mixed bathing is traditional there in these baths, which are at the edge of a high cliff overlooking the magnificent Pacific. Adding to the atmosphere of healing is a cadre of dedicated massage workers who practice a variety of body therapies. Wide green lawns that run right down to the cliff's edge further soothe the eye, and the food, which is prepared with love and enthusiasm, is out of this world.
So, as you can imagine, I was very pleased to have the opportunity to first spend a night visiting my friend Lee, and then moving on to assist my friend Ron with a weekend workshop on the alchemy of change and transition. We had a wonderful group of about 30 people. You may recall that I interviewed Ron in Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 29, and he's also the fellow I've been co-leading groups with in Europe. If the name Jampolsky rings a bell, it may be because I interviewed Lee's father, Dr. Jerry Jampolsky, in episode number 35. Although it didn't actually come up in my interview with Lee by name, both Lee and his father have been strongly influenced by a book called A Course in Miracles. Actually, this course consists of three volumes, a text setting forth a theoretical system, a workbook for students containing 365 daily lessons, and a manual for teachers. I've not gone through this material myself, but I know a number of people who have found it to be a powerfully positive influence in their lives. In addition, it spawned a number of other books which you can find on Amazon by doing a search on A Course in Miracles. I'm under the impression that this course is information that was channeled through a psychic individual, and also that it has a strong Christian flavor in its orientation. At the same time, however, I'm told that it doesn't demand belief in Christianity as much as it seeks to be a course in training the mind to develop such virtues as love, forgiveness, compassion, and so on. Whatever the case, these teachings have created miracles in the lives of both Jerry and Lee Jampolsky, and they will be the first to tell you so.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
I don't know if you can hear it in my voice, but I evidently caught some kind of minor bug on my trip. So if my voice sounds unusually hoarse or thin, that's why. Hey, thanks to all of you who have completed our listener survey. At this point, we're up to 54 completed surveys, and I'm hoping that the number will go up to 100 or more in the next week or so. If you haven't filled it out yet, please do so. You'll find it at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm. And also, there's a link on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. For everyone who completes the survey, includes their name and email address, I'm going to send you a link to a radio talk on dreams I gave before a live audience at the University of New Hampshire. So if you're listening in your car or on a walk, please remember to do it first thing when you get back home. It only takes a few minutes. Meanwhile, we have 9 new additions to our Frapper map, and I want to give a big thank you and welcome to Axel in Basel, Switzerland, Justin in Shanghai, China, Tony in Provo, Utah, Michael in Australia, Alana in Australia, Liz in Medford, New Jersey, Bob in Kitchener, Ontario, Canada, Peter in Copenhagen, Denmark, Anthony in Didcot, England. Thank you, folks. And if you're not on the map yet, you can add yourself to our growing Frapper map. All you have to do is go to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio. Or you'll find a link to Frapper on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com, and you'll be entered into a drawing for a free copy of a book I co-authored. And as I mentioned once before, listener Jonathan Denwood is working on reworking our website, and he keeps urging me to add a blog and a discussion forum. And if I move in that direction, I'm going to need some volunteer help from one or two people who have the time, some experience with these modalities, and reasonable familiarity with the field of psychology to serve as moderators. I know I've got some psychology graduate students and other professionals out there who would have the qualifications to do something like this, so if you feel so moved, let me know. And speaking of website development, don't forget you can get great discounts on a whole range of web services at GoDaddy.com by using either Shrink 1, Shrink 2, or Shrink 3 on checkout. You can find out more about those codes on our website. And if you're not already subscribed to Shrink Wrap Radio, let me encourage you to do so. It costs you nothing to subscribe, and it means you get the shows automatically, and I can better track how many people are listening. And you can subscribe through iTunes or Podshow at podshow.com or Juice or a variety of other podcatchers and RSS readers.
Hey, this is Matt Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
We've got some great listener emails in our mailbag. First, we hear from artist and longtime listener Ken Valerio, who writes, "Hey, Dr. Dave, the shows have been wonderful as usual. The forgiveness show was right up my alley. I love results-based thinkers, and the art therapy piece really gave me a deeper insight into my own practice. Yeah, I was hoping that you in particular and a couple of the other artist friends out there would resonate to that show on art therapy, so I'm glad to hear that it did." Ken goes on to write, "The reason I'm writing actually is to share some thoughts on Dr. Trumbull's remarks from episode number 57, concerning the validity of brain research and psychology. As I love analogies, this issue of brain research and the seemingly assumed dichotomy between it and more behavioral models reminds me of a current schism in the space exploration world. There are two schools in the space exploration programs, one which believes that more science is retrieved from unmanned probes that are cheaper, and two, those who believe that man's and women's presence in space is an integral part of the science and should not be subtracted from the science. I think about this tension when I hear issues of the brain and those who believe that a better understanding of its architecture will help us address dysfunctional behavior, and those seeing the brain as a bit more plastic see behavior itself as the starting point. My personal opinion as a layman is once, given a full knowledge of the brain, we will then be challenged with the question that I believe scientists are avoiding: what is normative behavior and how does that relate to the structure of society? And two, that behavioral research puts us at the collision point of this question. We are forced to ask ourselves daily if we are helping a larger disease by realigning the brain to operate in a system where some maladaptive behavior might be a healthy warning sign. Just some thoughts as usual to stay in the philosophical aspect of psychology. It might be great to have a show where you bring two guests from two different perspectives to discuss such issues. All my best, Dr. Dave, Ken. P.S. I'm one of those who believes that the human presence in space exploration is essential." Ken, thanks so much for sharing these thoughts with us. You make some good points. I like the idea of having multiple guests at the same time doing some point-counterpoint and actually have a show in mind in which I may be able to pull that off. And I think you raise a good point as well about the ever-present danger of psychologists getting people to adapt to a larger society which may be, in fact, unhealthy. Next, we hear from Anthony, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, your shows are great. I really enjoy listening to them. I was recently listening to your interview with Daniel Amen, number 55, and heard him say that, quotes, 'If I make the right intervention, I can actually make your brain better. If I give you the wrong medicine, if I do the wrong treatment for you, then I'll make your brain worse.' This made me think of a passage in a book called Person-Centered Counseling in Action by Dave Mearns and Brian Thorne, which I've read because I'm very interested in person-centered counseling and the work of Carl Rogers. And this passage seems like quite a contrast to what Dr. Amen said on your show. Quotes, "New practitioners can be afraid of their power in the counseling relationship and may feel that if they do anything wrong, it will profoundly damage the client. In fact, clients are not so easily damaged. A client who has had considerable trouble in his life is likely to have developed quite sophisticated defenses which he can use to protect himself from the erring counselor. The counselor's mistakes may waste the client's time, but unless they are malevolently intended, they seldom result in lasting damage, end quote. That's from the Person-Centered Counseling in Action book that he mentioned. And he goes on to write, "Personally, though, I was struck by the contrast between what your guest was saying and what the book says. I don't think there's any contradiction here. Daniel Amen actually prescribes drugs to his patients, and I can easily imagine that there would be undesirable consequences if he was to prescribe the wrong drug. Mearns and Thorne are talking about a form of therapy that is purely based on talking and largely driven by the client rather than the therapist, so the situation is somewhat different. Anyway, I was wondering how serious you think the consequences are likely to be when a therapist gets it wrong. Best wishes, Anthony." Well, Anthony, I really have to agree with the authors you cite, Mearns and Thorne, that by and large, I find people to be very resilient. Certainly, it's possible to for a therapist to be damaging, even in talk therapy, say, particularly if there are ethical violations, such as when a therapist might seduce a client, and certainly we know that that can be very destructive. But by and large, I agree with those authors that say that people are very resilient, and so I don't think we have to be overly concerned about that. Dr. Amen's comment about, if I give you the wrong medicine, if I do the wrong treatment for you, then I'll make your brain worse, that was a little bit startling when he said it, although I understood the context in which he meant it, and that he wasn't really threatening to make anybody's brain worse. So thanks a lot for your email. I really appreciate it. Longtime listener Michael in Illinois sent me some fascinating web links, which I'll need to follow up on. One was about brain research among people who speak in tongues, and that was very fascinating. And he also sent me several links to a center at the University of Pennsylvania on, it's called the Center for Spirituality and the Mind. And I was unaware of that center, even though I'm a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, but of course that was a long time ago. So thanks for those links, Michael. Well, I'm continually amazed and flattered by what bright and articulate and well-informed listeners I have, and the next email certainly illustrates that. The subject line, of course, spoke to me when it says, "I love your show," with lots of exclamation marks, and it goes on, "Greetings, Dr. Dave. I'm a professional classical cellist who spends a lot of time traveling between various playing engagements, and I cannot tell you how much I enjoy listening to your show. I got onto your site to take your survey, but I cannot find the link, and you sent it to me, and I did do that. I also wanted to get the recommended reading list for the show with Dr. Lovell on the expressive art therapy resources, and I have sent those along as well. I am very interested in nonverbal means of integratively processing complex emotions and the transformative possibilities in meaning-making via art. Because I make my living as a cellist, though I do find it transmutes and expresses many complex emotional states, I find that I truly need other forms of expressive art outlets, which I don't actually need to be good at in order to express and integratedly respond to all the dimensions of living. I'm curious if you're going to do any shows on dissociation and multi-level cognitive trauma processing. I know there's a lot of confusion and professional infighting regarding terminology and methodology in this arena, and I was wondering what your thoughts are on this." And I'm assuming here that you're referring to what most people think of as multiple personality. And I will be looking for a good guest in that area. The author, Gita, goes on to say, "I worked as a detox counselor and experienced firsthand that there are a lot of people struggling with self-medicating a multiplicity of dissociative levels of processing, and how, in fact, to integrate complex emotions and developmental processing issues and I feel that dual diagnosis procedures are confusing and not inherently integrated in approach. There's such a plethora of extreme opinions on multiplicity, dissociation, and memory controversy, little of which is actually helpful to people struggling with developmental issues and dissociative reflexes to the complexities of integrating emotions and cognitive processing in coping with living. I believe that cognitive behavioral approaches sometimes miss how deep and basic some of the developmental conflicts and emotional processing complexities are. AA is very beneficial and over time can become a very integrated approach to learning how to cope with and manageably process living a day at a time, but not everyone is able to hang in long enough with AA to be able to experience these benefits. And of course, AA refers to Alcoholics Anonymous. Some years back, I came across a book by Sarah Y. Krakauer. You can search for it online at Amazon. I was so impressed with her approach in mitigating the transferential complexities for her clients by structuring her role as facilitating their own imagistic abilities in connecting with their own intact inner core that I spoke with her and found her to be a remarkably engaging person to interview, so I thought you might be interested in interviewing her sometime. I think this is an approach that deserves much more exposure, as I believe it successfully navigates integrating what is most helpful to her clients without much of the distracting side trails of other current, much fought over approaches and modalities. While writing this, I just noticed that she's speaking at the ISSD convention this week in Los Angeles. So I'll need to follow up on that clue. In any event, I absolutely love your show and do indeed look forward to listening to more episodes and getting your book recommendations on art expressive therapies and, of course, a link to your survey as well. I think this larger classroom you are making possible is such a wonderful opportunity, and I'm very excited and inspired by your podcast. Keep enjoying all the possibilities you're truly making available to all of us eager listeners. With much gratitude, Gita. I think it's pronounced Gita. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Well, I have to tell you, I was very excited and inspired by your email, Gita. And it came at a most welcome time because somebody left a terrible review on iTunes for the show in which they claimed that, well, it was their perception that I'm a terrible interviewer, that I project nothing but boredom and disinterest. And what else? Well, you can read it for yourself on iTunes. And many of you seem to feel differently, and so I would encourage you to leave your own review on iTunes if you do, to help jack up my score there, which has fallen from 5 stars now down to 4 stars because of the 2 negative reviews. But it's really true. You cannot please everybody all the time, and that's such an important lesson in this life for me, and I think for most of us. Okay, that's enough for now. I'll save the remaining emails for the next episode. You can send your email to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod. And you're also encouraged to leave voice messages on MyChingo, and you'll find a link to that on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. Thanks again to my good friend, Dr. Lee Jampolsky, for the interview. And I want to let you know that my next show will be about the emerging field of positive psychology. I've already done that interview, and I can assure you it's a lively one. We close with a piece of pod-safe music from the classical genre. It's the ever-popular Pachelbel Canon in D major, performed on the piano by Mario Ajero. You'll find a link to this tune in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.